Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to season 4 of Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast, with me, Caroline Foran. I cannot believe we are 4 seasons in. To kick off this brand new series, of which there will be 15 amazing episodes, if I do say so myself, that makes world-class experts on anxiety in with everyday people's anxiety stories, as always, I am joined by the incredible Brian Penny. Now, I don't need to give him much of an introduction because his story of overcoming adversity just speaks for itself. Brian is a recovered addict. He's the author of the phenomenal memoir Bonus Time, which I urge you to read. And he's now undertaking a PhD, spending his time educating people on psychology and neuroscience. And at the root of all that Brian has been through, you will find anxiety. So he shares his story of anxiety here with me. I don't doubt that his story will resonate. He has a wonderfully realistic relationship with anxiety these days, and he also has some wonderful resources available to others via his website, which is brianpenny.com, and that is BRIANPENNIE.com. I really hope you enjoy it, and welcome back. Brian, thank you so much for being a guest on season 4 of Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast. I have been so looking forward to you and to chatting to you. And I've had so many people who have read your book who have said, you have to talk to this guy, like he would be perfect. Your story, from what I hear, is incredible. Now, full disclosure, I haven't actually read it yet myself, but it is next on my list. So I just want to start by saying a massive congratulations on the launch and the success of Bonus Time.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. And I'm delighted to be here. Been dying to chat to you. A good friend of mine seen you speak at Primark a while ago, and she was saying, oh, you've got to link up with Caroline. So it's great. It's great to be finally linking together today.
Oh, amazing. That's so nice. I always feel like no one is ever like paying attention at those things, or, you know, with your own podcast, you think maybe your mom is listening if you're lucky, but that's nice to hear. So you have an incredible story and I want you to tell it to me. So if we can just go back to the very beginning, and before we started recording there, you said it goes right back to birth. Is that right?
It goes right back to birth, Caroline. Yeah. And it's an interesting one. I only realized this after writing my memoir, writing my book in the summer, how big an effect this, big an impact this had on me. So when I was born with a condition known as intestinal malrotation, which in layman's terms, it simply means that my guts were twisted, my intestines were twisted. And after a week, and I wasn't eating, food wasn't going well, milk wasn't going down well, and my mom kept on bringing me back to the hospital, and the doctors just thought it was colic, and she was a young mother at the time, and they were sort of like, they were treating her like a silly young mother, it's colic, it's okay, it's okay. So a couple of, I think 2 or 3 weeks went by, and barely any nutrients getting into my body, and my mom just remembers I was like limp and frail, and like I was actually dying. She didn't know that at the time. So she brought me into the hospital for the last time, and they basically weighed me, and I was only like 3 pounds. I'd lost over half of my birth weight, and they knew they made a huge mistake. So it was literally ambulance jobs, police escort, rushed over, I think it was Harcourt Street Hospital at the time, emergency surgery. And this might shock you yourself, Caroline, it shocks a lot of people when they hear this, but back in I was born in 1978, so back in 1978, the medical practice at the time understood that infants did not need a general anaesthetic. It was only in 1985 when there was a woman in America realised her infant baby had heart surgery without general anaesthetic. There was a huge outcry, and he realised that he made this massive boo-boo from 1940s neurological evidence on pinprick, and so it was a huge mistake that he made for years. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So I basically went under the knife without a general anaesthetic.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's absolutely crazy, isn't it? It's really, I'm rubbing my scar on my stomach now. Like, I still struggle with a bit of trauma around that. I've done a lot of work around that myself. But basically, I had a lot of complications. I survived. Yeah, I was only given 5% chance of living, but I survived the operation. And I had complications from that operation as well. And I remember my aunt saying to me, my mum, literally for the first 18 months of my life, I cried. I, like, 24/7, I cried from pain of the complications. And since I've gone back to study psychology, I'm doing a PhD in Trinity around this kind of stuff as well. And what I've come to learn and what I've come to realize is that I was literally primed for a life of anxiety, to fear the world, to fear my environment. And that was the starting point for me to experience anxiety. And I suppose it set the path for the rest of my life.
Oh my God. So like the minute you were born, you were facing all these threats, your body was in protection mode, and your little mind wouldn't have even had a hope of understanding anything like that was going on. So of course that was going to set the tone. And then what was it like growing up then?
Growing up for me, so I always say that now, I came from a very loving family, a very loving parents, but it was a problematic home as well. It was alcohol in the home, an alcoholic home, I suppose. And what I remember, we had no language for anxiety back then, especially I was only a kid at this stage. I didn't even know what it was. But I just remember being a very restless, agitated and worried child. I worried about everything. I used to describe like it's sirens in my head. Mm. I remember one memory specifically. I was watching a World War film with my dad and a siren went off. I think it was the Vietnam War. And I remember the next day I was playing up in my room and I heard a similar noise. And I thought World War III was happening outside. And I was running down to tell everyone about it. Very, very maladaptive kind of thinking patterns and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But there was one specific memory that I think had a huge impact on my life as well. It was a memory of over a couple of years. And my mum and dad were drinkers, as I said. But back then as well, there was a lot of drink driving went on. So I was very aware as a kid, like from the ages of 6 to 9 years of age. I just remember from Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, my mum and dad going to the pub, driving. I'd start my window watch at about 10 o'clock, waiting for them to come home. And I just remember every car that came down the road, hoping it was them. It wouldn't be them. They wouldn't get in until about 2 a.m. And I just remember the anxiety that used to go through my body. So that's one of the biggest memories for me as a kid growing up. And I think it just shaped me towards a life of anxiety. I was very sensitive towards anxiety from the earlier experiences. And that just really made the situation a lot worse.
And people really underestimate the impact of experiences at around that age. And, you know, an adult might just say, oh, don't be silly, don't be ridiculous. But I mean, I'm sure you've learned this yourself as well. And looking back on my childhood, I would, you know, I now realize and understanding the brain better. And for me, it's so eye-opening to realize that your ability to have stored those long-term memories and have that fear response was well in place before you had the ability to like rationalize and tell yourself it's okay, because that part of your brain wasn't going to really develop until a few years later. So those things really were woven into the fabric of your being. And it's so, it sets the tone for life. If we don't understand it and we don't intervene at that time, no wonder so many of us are walking around with slight traumas of things that seem so innocuous from childhood.
Yeah, 100%. It's like there was a great book I read. I think the body keeps the score, and like we're conditioned. It goes into the body, and there was a lovely line I heard as well. Congratulations, you survived the war. Now live with the trauma. So you probably got over that experience. And adults are saying don't be silly, but that trauma is in your body. Like I do a lot of public speaking now, and I still get a little bit anxious sometimes. We're going to be chatting about that. I have a wonderful relationship with anxiety today, but I still feel it in the body. But it's not blind right now. It's the conditioned self that was traumatized in the past. That's where it's really coming from.
Yeah. So you're about 8 or 9 at that point. You're definitely already have a very kind of hypervigilant mind, and your body's always erring on the side of caution. Take me then forward to what was going on in your life, and what was the driving force behind where you ended up going down the route of taking drugs?
Yeah, it was funny for me. So I've always had great self-belief in my abilities, even though I ended up as a heroin addict for 15 years. I had great self-belief. Like I was fairly academic in school. I was a good footballer. So I either thought I was going to be a footballer or I was going to have a good career. That's where I was at. And when I was 14, I came from a very disadvantaged area, in fairness, very drug-riddled area, robbed cars, violence. But I didn't see myself in that setting. I wasn't one of them, as I used to say to myself. I wasn't going to be robbing cars. But and I never smoked cigarettes. I remember my friends were smoking cigarettes. I was like, no way would I smoke cigarettes. That's stupid. Ruin me football career. That was my mindset. But I had an injury when I was 14 and I didn't play for a couple of months. And I must have been getting curious about drugs at that age as well. Because I remember on the football dressing room, the roof of the football dressing room, we were messing around. I'll never forget it. And my friend Alan turns around and says, oh, the head buzz you get off these cigarettes. And I was like, oh, head buzz. Oh, I wouldn't smoke because it's dirty, filthy, and it affect me career. He spit me football career. But I wouldn't mind a head buzz. And it always sticks in my head, that is. And I remember I was a big Samson roll-up tobacco cigarette, and I took a puff. And I loved the little head buzz. That was my starting point for drugs. And my brother Calvin was smoking hash at the time. And I knew that. I was aware a couple of my older friends were smoking hash as well. And within a couple of weeks and months after that, I was smoking hash, I was taking tablets. And I believe it was just, it gave me a sense of relief to get away from this sense of restlessness, the sense of anxiety that I felt. I started drinking at 15, 14, 15. And it just took me away from me, took me away from the anxiety. Didn't realize it at the time. Now, I started getting into harder drugs then as well. And then when I was 17, I dabbled in methadone, not realizing it was a heroin substitute at 16. But I start dabbling when I was early 70, and I took heroin for the first time, and that was literally the game changer for me. It was, I remember that experience. There's a chapter in my book called Falling in Love, and it's literally my first night talking about doing heroin. And I just remember it was like, I describe it as like a soft, warm blanket was just wrapped around my soul. And it was like a voice came into me. It was just like, keep me close, I'll protect you. And that was game over for me. I didn't get addicted straight away, but I was mentally addicted, and I was going to keep that close for the rest of my life.
I'm always so curious about addiction to drugs. And when you hear about, you know, obviously when you're in the throes of addiction, it's completely understandable that it's not something you have much control over. But when you made that first decision, being as aware and smart and, like you say, academic and everything, and knowing that cigarettes would affect your career, do you remember knowing consciously that you're potentially going to go down like a path that you couldn't go back from, which you obviously have come back from, and deciding, I don't care anyway, I'm going to do it?
Yeah, so this is the thing. People that hear my story think it's a story, and read the book probably think it's a story of addiction, and it is to an extent, obviously, but I would say it's more a story of self-deception. There's a line in my book that really captures the essence of what I was like all the way through my adulthood. And I was a black belt in self-deception. I could cross any boundary or take any action by telling myself a lie and believing it. So I really believed the stories that I told myself. And my story was, I'm not a real addict. I used to tell myself I had a secret that you can do, if you're like me or you're not like real addicts, you can do heroin once a week or twice a week and get away with it. I'm nearly thinking other people are silly. So I fed myself these lies, which are like preposterous now, really crazy lies now. But I fully believed these lies in the moment that protected me and allowed me to go deeper into addiction without realizing that I was getting into serious, serious trouble.
Yeah. And were you conscious, or were you aware at the time, at the beginning, you know, when you say you had that feeling of that comfort blanket in the drug experience, were you aware of what that feeling was masking for you, or what it was solving for you? Or was it just like, this feels good? Or did that only come later that you realized it was anxiety? Because it sounds like you just kind of always were an anxious person, and then this made you feel a little bit less like an anxious person.
Yeah, that's it. You've nailed it there, Caroline. I remember, so that would have been in 1995 around. That would have been in 95. And I don't think there was a language. I certainly had never heard of anxiety at that stage.
Oh, God.
And yeah, definitely. It wouldn't have been, yeah. And I remember, so I started dabbling in heroin when I was 17. And I think it was 19 or 20 when I was starting to do coke. I was starting to do a lot of other drugs at this time, partying and everything else. And I was making myself much worse in the anxiety stakes. And I had my first panic attack when I was 19. And it was a horrific experience. I thought I was dying. I didn't know what a panic attack was at the time. And I remember going to the doctor and him telling me I struggle with anxiety. That's a psychological thing. And I was like, anxiety, what is that? I didn't even know what it was. And I remember he gave me Valium at the time to help me with the anxiety, but I was already taking a lot of drugs and taking heroin at the time. But it gave me the realization that drugs were the solution for this as well. But that was really my first realization that I was masking something underlying that. But I didn't really fully realize that up until I got clean. And yeah. I'd go as far as saying that, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so you're 17, are you fully addicted at this point?
No, so 17, I was, there was 2 years of dabbling in heroin, and like military precision, I would use it. Me and my best mate, he was still on the streets, he's still on the streets, he's still deep in addiction. And basically, we'd use it with military precision so we wouldn't get strung out, in inverted commas, like we weren't real addicts, we'd never get strung out. And I think when I was 19 or 20 and I had that panic attack, and I remember going to the doctor and he gave me the Valium. He wouldn't give me more Valium because I was looking for more Valium. And I remember making a decision, like I know heroin helps this now, so I'm going to have to do heroin. You're not giving me the drugs. So I nearly blamed the doctor. And so when I was 19 and 20, that's when I got fully deep into addiction, and when I started getting physically strung out on heroin and developing physical withdrawal symptoms and having to do it on a much, much more regular basis.
And how did that impact your life at the time then?
It's crazy. And a lot of people struggle to understand this, and it's more common than you think. So I was a functional addict for nearly all of me. Well, I wasn't. I thought I was a functional addict for most of my addiction. When I talk to people that about that, he says I wasn't very functional at all. But I held down a job for pretty much all of my addiction. And for the first 10 years, because I didn't think I was a real addict, I didn't really act like a real addict. So I was a registered addict from the age of 22, I think. So I was on a methadone program. I was given urines once a week. I was drinking methadone and the chemist once a week. Still doing heroin every day, by the way, because the methadone program doesn't work. So that was just an extra way of making sure that I wouldn't be dying sick and I could go to work still. It was a relentless grinding and slow process in my 20s of just grinding me down. But I still tried to live the other life. I still tried to, I always say it was like two worlds colliding. So it was like one world, the real me was the anxiety ridden me that was doing heroin on the side, trying to keep it away from everybody. And then there was the outside me, that the outside self that I tried to show everyone else that life was grand, I was okay, I was working a job, the story that was protecting the addiction. So as long as I kept up that facade, I was protecting the addiction. So it was self-deception. I was deceiving everyone else. I was lying to everybody. And it was only a matter of time before that really collapsed. And that really started collapsing then at the end of my 20s and my 30s. I started selling drugs. I started bringing a lot of problems to my house. My mom's house got burnt down. The front of the house got burnt down. All the problems I brought to the house, like, I got to move out. So I started becoming the stereotypical problem that you would expect around people in addiction then after that.
And you say that you were successful in kind of concealing, deceiving yourself and deceiving everyone else around you. Was there anyone who called you out on it, who really cared about you at the time, who made you, and I presume you would have reacted badly to that, but who could see the wood from the trees when you couldn't?
Yeah, there was a couple of people, and it was even in the clinic. It was like they used to say to me, says it was very tired to just talk to me. It was like a verbal diarrhea just came out of me. It was like a machine gun. So I had this ability to protect my addiction with BS, basically. Mm-hmm. So I remember my mom and my sister and my best friend trying to talk to me at times. But I always had these defense mechanisms. Like I always had these stories. I'm getting off methadone. I only use it to soothe anxiety. Look at this. I'm down to this amount of milliliters. I'm down to this amount of tablets. I pretend I was never doing heroin. That was my own little secret. So I was saying I'm on a methadone program. I'm trying to get off. I'm trying to look after myself. So I had this whole complex network of lies and deceptive stories to get people off my case, and that's what it was.
Did you want, like, you're saying all this, like, oh, I'm doing this, I'm in the clinic, like, did you actively want to improve things, or were you just saying I've got to do this to keep people off my back, but I'm quite happy continuing as I am?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I'm big, and so my whole thing is it's about the stories we tell ourselves. My career is going to be down on the lines of self-talk, negative thinking, all of this stuff, and the impact of the language we use, especially when we're talking to ourselves, and the emotion. Like, language is a vehicle for emotion. So I'm all about the stories we tell ourselves. And what I've come to realize was that we have many stories, obviously. We have many narratives that we tell ourselves. But my major narrative was this: I cannot cope with anxiety and I need heroin to survive. So I didn't think there was another way out. I got myself into a hole and I didn't think there was another way of living. Obviously, as the anxiety was getting worse and I was doing more drugs, it was like a snake trying to eat its own tail. Like it was making it worse and I was trying to do it to make it better. But I just didn't think there was a way out. I was getting deeper into debt. So I had to try to keep my job. I had to try to sell more drugs. But everything was getting worse. But I just couldn't see a way out. So I didn't even go there, would be the answer. I didn't even think it was possible.
What was the turning point? I mean, how bad did things have to get before you arrived at that point yourself where you said, okay, I can't feel myself or anyone anymore?
Yeah, and this is the defining point of my life, Caroline. I remember, so it was August 2013, and I pretty much lost everything. I lost my job. I lost my mind. I went to a form of psychosis to an extent, in and out of psychosis, crazy thinking. I lost my health. I don't know if you've ever seen the before after pictures. I look like a different person. Yeah.
Completely different person.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And I lost every important relationship in my life. And I remember realizing, right, I still didn't think I could get off drugs because I didn't think I could survive without them. But I remember saying, right, I'm going to have to get clean. I'm going to have to try to go to a detox center and do something else. I was like, I have to do something. And I went to my old clinic and I tried to get into a detox center. I remember thinking, I'm going to do some, I'll get out and I'll do some drugs, but I'll try to control it better. That was the new story I was telling myself. Mm-hmm. And I went to the detox center and they told me I couldn't get into detox with benzodiazepine in my system. There was one place I could go, but I'd have to wait 6 weeks. But I was nearly dying at this stage. Like, I think my body was giving up and I was really, really in a bad way. And there was something within me sort of saying, you need to do this now. You need to do something now. Like, I'd lost my job. I'd lost any way of earning money, and I owed out like tens of thousands to money lenders, drug dealers. I'd nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And I says, right, I'm going to have to do this now. And I remember saying, right, I remember in the clinic and saying, right, I'm going to do a home detox. And they says, don't do that. It says, you'll have a seizure. You could kill yourself. You'd be in a bad way. And I says, look, I have to do this now. So I tried to do a home detox, trying to get off the benzodiazepine so I could, they'd be out of my system so I could get into a detox to get off the opiates.
And what did that involve, a home detox?
Just sitting at home in pain, waiting for a benzodiazepine to come out of my system.
Jesus.
Yeah, crazy. And what I'll describe is, so 2 days into that home detox, so I'm in the sitting room. I'm moving into a new apartment now next week, but I'm in the sitting room. I'm in the kitchen right now of the house, and the sitting room is right to me right hand side. It's how I started my book, actually, with the prologue. And I described that night, 2 days into my home detox, I described that night as not only the most painful night in my life, but the most important night in my life. And 2 days into that home detox, I woke up and me sitting on the floor and there was blood everywhere. And in what the detox facility said, I actually did have a grand mal convulsive seizure. So what happens when a convulsive seizure is that every neuron in your brain, I had a grand mal one, so it's every neuron in my brain, like a cascading effect, fired at the same time. So my muscles were all convulsing, all my sensory senses were convulsing, and I'd actually driven my teeth through my tongue. So I pierced the center of my tongue with my teeth through the convulsion, and that's where all the blood was coming from. And I remember my younger brother came into the room, he thought I was dead. He rang me dad in a panic, I think Brian's dead from withdrawals, and I was brought to the hospital. Thankfully, I wasn't dead. Ambulance job. Like, it was a horrific scene and it was horrible for the whole family who rallied around me after me tormenting them for years. So I owe so much to my family. I really do. But the moment in the hospital for me that changed everything, I was in a room on my own, lying on a trolley. And basically when you do drugs to escape anxiety, like if they help you to escape anxiety, withdrawal is the opposite of that. I describe it like a spring being wound really, really tightly, and the withdrawal is like an unleashing of that spring. So I remember just being on the trolley, just trying to jump out of my own skin, and I was just emotionally, mentally, and physically broken, like physically from the seizure, and my tongue was so sore. But what I'll never forget is that I tried to get up off the hospital trolley, and my eyes just landed on this fire extinguisher. It was a red fire extinguisher, and not to me that night, which was really crazy. And I remember just being sort of transfixed and lost, like tunnel vision, looking at this fire extinguisher. And I remember saying, right, it's a fire extinguisher, and that's the colour red. But I tried to put it together, and it says that's a red fire extinguisher. It was like the world of me, verbal world, didn't make sense anymore. Mm-hmm. I really describe it like links of a chain that I knew should go together, but I didn't know how to connect it anymore. And I remember just looking around the room, and it was like nothing really made sense verbally anymore. And I started to panic, saying, oh my God, am I brain damaged? Is this brain damage? And I remember just leaning back in the trolley in this sense of, I wouldn't say calm, but it was a sense of, I can't do this. I just can't do this anymore. And I surrender. It was a sense of surrender. And I believe that was the moment that changed my life. I stopped fighting with reality. I stopped fighting with my own mind. And I dropped the story that I told myself. And I think that was the defining moment where I was able to tell myself a new story and do something else with my life. And from there, for me, that was the moment when my life completely changed.
Wow. What was scarier to you? The idea that you could potentially continue down that path and wake up dead? Or was it scarier to think of, okay, I have to confront these demons now. I'm going to have to feel the full brunt of this anxiety when I've had a perfectly good, I guess, mask for it this whole time. Which one of those was scarier to you?
Yeah, it was funny. That's a great question, actually. And fear. I think fear had sort of left me at that stage, Carolyn. For me, it was at that stage, it was all about confusion. Obviously, fear is the underlying emotion of it all. But it was a sense of confusion. I didn't know where I was going. I had no sense of direction anymore. And if I was to say anything, I would say the fear of staying in that mindset. I just knew it didn't work anymore. It didn't work anymore. And it was the fear of not knowing another way out. So I only had one way to go, and that was getting clean. I don't even know if that answers the question. It's a struggle for me to answer that, I have to say.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's perfect. So then you're at, I guess, the day one of mentally realizing, okay, I've got a massive journey ahead of me. Physically, you've got to claw yourself back from the brink of very, very being close to dying. Where did you find the strength, and how was the experience, and how long did it take, and did you ever feel like giving up along the way?
No, and this is where I'm eternally grateful for my journey, and I just feel so lucky that for what actually happened to me. So I had another 4 weeks after that seizure at home, waiting for the benzodiazepine to come out of my system. Another seizure, another hospital visit. That was the toughest month of my life, to be quite honest. Then I went to a detox facility on a farm up in Nall, and I spent 5 weeks coming off heroin. But around coming off heroin, my first day clean was the 8th of October 2013, and there was a huge shift in me being around that time. It was like an energy was coming into my life. Mm-hmm. I was starting to read about Eastern philosophy. I learned about meditation for the first time. And it was just like what I described. It was like this intense curiosity came into my life. How did I not know about these things? How did this stuff exist? And I didn't even know it was out there in the world. And I've talked to a couple of other psychologists about this. It was like I transformed addictions, or I swapped addictions. So I became intensely curious, intensely addicted, for want of a better word, about learning Eastern philosophy, the Mayan psychology, all of these different things. And so it's like I jumped onto a different roller coaster, a much safer and a much better roller coaster. But that's where it really happened for me. But on my fourth day clean, there was a huge perspective shift as well, which really drove the direction I went in. And I'll never forget, I got up that morning, and there was something about the world. It was just different, wonderfully different. This is how I describe it. And I remember walking out to the farm that morning, and it was like, it was a beautiful October dew-soaked morning. I'll never forget it. Blue skies, and I remember the dewdrops on the grass were just like diamonds, like sparkling sparkling on the grass. I remember it was a real misty morning as well. I could feel everything. It was like nature was breathing on me. I'd never really experienced that like it before. And what I've come to realize was that the suffering or whatever happened, I got intensely present. It was like that my mind went quiet. I was forced to stop thinking, and my mind went quiet. And it was like anxiety left me.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So that really pushed me on a path to do a degree in psychology, where I'm doing a PhD now, and why I'm so interested in the relationship between language and emotion, self-talk and emotion, because when my mind went quiet, anxiety left me, and my mind has gotten busier again. That didn't last for too long. So I'm not that lucky. And anxiety, normal anxiety, has come back into my life, obviously, as well. But that sort of set me on a path to really just push forward and have a purpose in my life. And although I have had challenges on the way, obviously, it gave me a huge advantage, really, to have that drive to find out what actually went on. Like, why didn't I suffer? How could I share my suffering with other people? These were questions that I was trying to answer from them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned self-talk and the power of that. Were there kind of key self-talk swaps you made in that time, or key, I guess, core beliefs that you held about yourself from the depths of the addiction to this new point where you had to like rewrite the narrative that you feed yourself?
Definitely. And there was loads of little narratives. I remember there was one tune that was replaying in my head when I was in detox, when all of this sort of shift was happening. And it was like, it was an awe-inspiring, wow, I have a life again. I couldn't believe I had a life again. I was like, oh my God, I have a life again. I have a chance to live again. This is crazy. And it was a real gratitude for that. But the narrative I have now, which defines every aspect of my life, it's the first line of the chapter of my book, actually, is I'm the happiest person I know. Adversity doesn't stop me. It fuels my ability to thrive. So that second part of that narrative has come a bit later. Like, adversity doesn't stop me. It fuels my ability to thrive. But any challenges, any stumbling blocks I come across now, I always focus on progress and growth and look at a way of learning from it rather than letting it affect me. And that would be the huge narrative of my life today, trying to look at everything from the opposite end of the spectrum, and see it as a potential learning point instead of a challenge.
Absolutely. I mean, and you've had the ultimate experience in that. How did your relationship with your own vulnerability change? Because I think for me, I've talked about this so much in this podcast and in my books, but I always say this, but I think we're all walking around petrified about our own vulnerability and completely afraid to show it, whether it's in a professional environment or in a relationship. And it's actually like it's the roadblock to so many, I think, personal issues. And only when, for me, when I started to kind of embrace my vulnerability and be willing to confront it and I guess own it, did it change from being something that held me back and made me feel, I guess, weaker or different, to being actually, this is kind of my secret power and this is my greatest strength. And if only we could all realize that, how much our relationships would improve, how much, I mean, look where your career is now, like where my career is now, because I made that change with vulnerability. And it, I guess for so long, behind the heroin and everything, was this deep fear of vulnerability.
100%. And there's a couple of layers to that. For me, like, it was the male ego, nearly afraid to talk about my feelings, afraid to admit I have feelings, afraid to say I had anxiety or I was afraid. That's what drove me addiction, because there's no way would I talk about that stuff. But the funny thing is, when I got clean, I would have considered myself embracing me vulnerabilities, embracing me fears and embracing me emotions. And I did, to an extent. And then when I wrote the book, I got into it more. I interviewed my family and talked to my family, and there was another huge shift as well. I could feel their pain. I really feel their pain, but I wasn't actually really 100% willing to go there. It's funny. It's funny the timing of this. So I met someone recently just before COVID kicked in. It's a very, very special person in my life now. And it's helped. She's helped me to see, to be vulnerable in a whole new way. Like, she sort of created a safe space for me to be completely vulnerable. And it's actually changed my relationships with my family. It's brought to a new level. It's been completely different. And it's only in the last few months that I understand vulnerability to its truest extent. And it, as you say, Kat, it's a superpower. Like, it's allowing me to be, it's dangerous in itself. Not dangerous is the wrong word, but you're putting yourself out there to be slapped. I'm really wearing my heart on my sleeve in a much more bigger way, and I'm feeling my emotions much more. I've nearly been on the brink of tears on a couple of occasions. I was doing a podcast or a talk with Philly McMahon, and he pushed all my buttons because he knew my story, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna break down here. But it is a superpower. It's like I feel it more than I can talk about it, but I just feel so much better in myself. Like, it's incredible.
How do you feel now when you find yourself in emotional discomfort?
I'm kind of embracing it. It's the old me is still there. I'd love to say he's completely gone. So the old me who wants to run away from his emotions is still there to an extent, but I'm catching him a lot more often. Like, self-observation would be one of my biggest tools in life, and I'm always observing myself, whether it's the self-talk and feelings. So I'm catching that now, and I'm saying, no, sit with it, let it be there. But there is still an element of that run away, protect yourself. There was a really good friend of mine, Yvonne Barnes-Holmes. She's an amazing psychologist that I done my undergrad with. And she was sort of said to me like that, I was in a position where I had to have this sort of protective ego for a while in recovery, because if I got vulnerable too quick, I probably would have gone back and relapsing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a defense mechanism as well, that I need to be a little bit like that, but I think I'm ready to completely embrace it. And the next year, I'm excited for the next year of my life to fully embrace my emotions in all contexts.
Is there always a fear of relapse?
Not for me. And it's really strange. So I had a little mini relapse in 2015, where I remember I started getting obsessed about college. Like, I went back to college. I wanted to be the best, and I wanted to do brilliant. And I was not beating other people. It was being better than who I was yesterday. I'm a very competitive person. And I remember when I was in Maynooth in 2015, that's where I went to college. And I remember looking at these giant sequoia trees and realizing, wow, I'm not losing this profound thing that happened to me, this perspective shift. I lost it. I haven't got that light, beautiful feeling anymore. And I was like, oh my God, I lost it in unawareness. And what I realized as well, I had flu symptoms around the time as well when I was doing deliveries, and I started taking sulpidine. I started taking a lot of sulpidine. Mm-hmm. So I know some people wouldn't even think of that as a relapse, but for me, that was a major relapse. Like, I was playing with opiates again. So that was really dangerous, and that happened in unawareness. So for me, like, some people, two things, people think sobriety is the opposite of addiction. For me, two things are the opposite of addiction: awareness and connection. That's what the opposite of addiction is. So a lack of awareness, if I lose that, that could bring me back into addiction and relapse. And anxiety, if I ever suffered massively with anxiety, I know that a short-term fix for that would be heroin, obviously. So that would be the danger, but I fully believe in the tools that I use. So I don't have any fears because of that.
Yeah. I think in so many stories like yours, we hear so much about these moments of enlightenment, like you say, that ultimate moment of presence where you were feeling the grass on your feet, and, you know, you just that's what I think inspires and motivates people to hopefully persevere through those really hard times. But it's also really important, like what you say there, is you're not going to be on this high of, wow, I've just gotten my life back forever. Eventually, time will move on. You'll start to adapt to your new normal. Things will start to stress you out as they would to anyone again. You'll have crappy days. And that's where you need to really be careful with the self-talk and the awareness.
Definitely, 100%. And I think people often ask me, look, I with me clients and stuff like that, and I'll say to them, if I have three words for anybody, it's consistency, consistency, consistency. It's putting the work in on a regular basis. And I think it's that preemptive work that protects you from this stuff, but you've got to put in the work. And I think whether it's morning routines, meditation, whatever works for you, exercise, it's keeping yourself on top of your game. And I think that's really, really important.
I presume what you've been through, not a day goes by without thinking of it. But do you ever catch yourself, getting worked up or frustrated about what you might consider more trivial day-to-day worries or anxieties or stresses, and actually find yourself grateful that that's now something that would bother you?
100%, 100%. I actually, it's funny, I find myself smiling at the inability to laugh at adversity. It was really strange, Carolyn. My book came out on the 27th of March, and I was lined up to go on the Late Late Show, and it was a big TV PR campaign. Not only did all of that get cancelled because of COVID-19, all of my books got trapped in the warehouse, and I couldn't even sell any books. They couldn't even get shipped to online delivery services. And I remember just sitting there getting that information. I was hurt in the body. I could feel it in the body. There was that space between stimulus and response. And I just started smiling at my ability to let go of what was outside of my control. I was smiling at my ability to not get overwhelmed by mm-hmm. something that some people will be wallowing in self-pity by. And I was just so grateful. And I remember thinking, this is a better feeling than getting on the bloody Ryan Tuberty show or selling books. Like, this was huge for me. And I was so grateful. It was crazy. And that happens on a very small base at times as well. Like, even in traffic, like someone beeping you off the road or someone getting mad, I'm like, wow, I'm just so grateful. I don't react like that anymore.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, God, you must be just walking around so zen all the time.
I wouldn't say that. I'm still in a busy mind, but I'm good at catching things. That's the thing. I catch things quick.
But that's the thing. I mean, it's not like you don't become a completely different person, or someone who struggles with anxiety doesn't just never feel anxiety again. You've learned to work with yourself instead of working against yourself.
Definitely, definitely. And I still experience anxiety. My anxiety always manifests itself around my chest, like a tightness in my chest. And especially I get into public speaking lately, and I was mm-hmm. petrified at the start. And even with any big talks, like, I always get this tight feeling around my chest, and it's loosening more and more over time. But self-observation, as I think I mentioned already, would be mm-hmm. the biggest tool I practice. I'm always observing my bodily sensations, my feelings and my thoughts. And I just observe it coming and say, oh, there you are. I'll watch it come and I'll watch it go. And it's like a sense of detachment from the things that used to control my life.
Exactly. And that kind of anxiety isn't a bad thing. I mean, your body was obviously primed from birth to protect you and to say, whoa, maybe this is a bit risky here. So it's still doing its job, and you don't want that part of your body to switch off. You just need to have the higher part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, the strength there and the resilience there to be able to mediate those worries and say, look, this is temporary. This is helping me prepare. And then I'm sure you always feel incredible when you step down off the stage.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And it's always before it. It's always before the talk. As soon as you get up there, it just releases.
Exactly.
And it's like, and it's like you're saying, like, it's like that, it's that fear of rejection, I think, is grounded. Like, it's 10,000 years ago, if you were rejected with your ancestors, like, you're kicked out of the cave and you're dead. So rejection is a huge thing from an evolutionary perspective. It's, and that's why anxiety is really, really important. Like, I think it has a bad label, but it has its use to help us survive.
Oh, absolutely. And so when you do feel it now, if you were to feel kind of panicky symptoms rising, maybe outside of giving a talk, what's your go-to? Do you have a mantra or the things that you say to yourself, or do you do some breathing exercises?
Yeah, there's a few things. A lot of things for me will be preemptive stuff. I have a very structured morning routine, which helps me for that. So I prime myself for the day. But if it happens in the moment, I think a few deep breaths cannot be underestimated. Like, you'll be activating the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest system, which is the opposite of your fear system, fear response system, stress response system. And I think people, the thing, because it's said so much, a couple of deep breaths, but this works. It physically changes your brain and changes your body. So a couple of deep breaths is a huge thing. And even before I do a talk, I take a couple of deep breaths as well. For a mantra that I'd use, and I got this from AA, it's not AA, doesn't own it, but it's like, this too shall pass. Mm-hmm. Everything passes, good and bad. It will pass, and it's not going to be on my gravestone. That's something I'll always say as well. Like, it's not even going to be on my mind in 2 days' time. Don't mind me, gravestone. It's not that big a deal. Get over it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so now you're studying, you've got your undergrad, you're doing your PhD in Trinity. It's incredible. Is this now your passion, and what is your goal with all of this work that you're doing?
I think the end goal, and it's starting to change. So I life skills, life tools and tactics for life is because I'm using tools that I know work so well with me, and it's sharing them with other people is really my mission. Like, it's like, change is possible, and I want to show people how to do that. That's sort of my mission in life. But specifically looking at the young people today, it's a big mission of mine is to get them to engage, to get them to realize that these tools are out there, and that what's important is to have a happy life, to have a fulfilled life, a life of purpose, and a life with energy. Look, for me, energy is the currency of life. And you can work on your energy, you can work on your happiness, and just to get this through to the younger generation, I think that's my number one goal, to get it through to everybody. But I specifically would love to find a way to get the younger generation to engage in this stuff. That's a huge goal of mine.
And I've no doubt that you'll succeed massively with that, and already are. But I'm curious that you have to have something in place there to protect yourself, in that you can control what you can control, and there's a lot outside of your control in terms of another person might not respond the same way you did. How do you, it's probably a two-part question, how do you, I guess, resign yourself to the fact that you won't be able to change the world to the extent that you've changed yourself? And also, now that you have this platform and people are, I mean, just because you've shared your vulnerability, that straight away people are resonating with that. They want to share with you their stories, but that is an awful lot for one person, for all those people to be putting on you their stories and asking for your advice. How do you self-protect from that?
Yeah, it's really difficult. So the first part of that question is, so I would say that you cannot change anybody. And a lot of the questions, that's a really related question as well, because so many people would send me emails and messages saying, my mother's an addict, my son's an addict, how can I get them to get out of addiction? And my message is, you cannot change anybody. You can plant the seed, but that's all you can do. And I think you've got to look after yourself. So my brothers were in addiction when I got clean, and I was trying to preach them. I was trying to give them the tools to show them how to get clean. But they never listened to me. They nearly went in the opposite direction. But it was only by seeing my actions now that what my brother is a year in recovery, only a month ago, and he's doing fantastically well. But it was through watching my actions. So I don't think you can change people. You can hope maybe to inspire people through your own actions. And show, as you were saying, showing your vulnerability, showing people what works, showing people that you're walking your talk, that you're actually doing what you say you're doing. And I think that's really important as well. And then planting the seeds, like putting the content out there, putting the videos out there and planting those seeds. I think that's the really key piece. But around so many people sending messages and stuff as well, and this is something that was causing anxiety in my life, it was causing stress in my life, because you want to help everybody. Mm-hmm. Only yesterday, I had a 17-year-old guy from China, I think it was Chinese, right, and of all places, his name was in Chinese, and he was saying, like, I'm 17 years old, I'm deep in addiction, can you please help me?
That's so hard.
It's so difficult. It's so, so difficult. And I know I can't help him, even if I had, like, possibly 10 sessions with him, I probably wouldn't be able to put that kind of work in, because he has to change himself. Yeah. And it's nearly a cry for help. And what I've resigned myself in doing is to just put people onto the content that I've written, the videos that I've done, the online course. And I deliver a lot of free material around that as well. Obviously, I'm developing online courses now that are going to be a lot more intricate, and I'm going to be charging for them as well. Mm-hmm. And I still do one-to-one sessions as well. If I don't do many of them, because I'm trying to come away from that, because I think my time would be better spent doing bigger things and trying to focus on bigger...
Reaching more people.
But it's really difficult. It's really, really difficult. And I think there's a lot of power in saying no, and It's saying no to, so you can, like, I think with Steve Jobs, it's only by saying no that you can focus on what's important in life. And that's really important when you're saying no to helping individual people. But if you can help more people by doing that, you have to weigh up, and it gets moral implications as well. It's really tough is the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, on a much smaller scale, I mean, I would have a lot of people messaging me about, you know, very crippling anxiety and what can I help them? And it's so hard, because you're not keeping back any secrets. You know, you're sharing everything whether it's through a podcast or your book or videos or putting it out on social media. There's no secret that I'm holding on to that people have to come and get from me personally. But if I find myself, you know, obviously because I know what it's like to be in that vulnerable position of just wanting someone to tell you it's going to be okay, I know what they feel like. So I just have this desperate feeling of wanting to drop everything and try and like wrap myself around this person. But you're one person. And like, I then find myself that I'm depleting. I mean, like they say, you can't pour from an empty cup, and you're depleting your resources so much. So it's really important as you have done this work for yourself now, not to, I guess, completely drain yourself in trying to solve the problems of the world, because we can only control what we can, and we have to relatively kind of let go of the rest.
100%. Something's just at the dropping for me. I have to thank you for that. It's like, we're not keeping any secrets. That's the whole thing. I think that's going to make it so much easier for me now. Like, everything, you know, we're not holding on to these little nuggets that we only tell people one to one. Like, every, you put everything out there. Like, I love that idea. Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah,
exactly. So for anyone listening now who is maybe really feeling the brunt of anxiety and thinking, oh, like, if there was just something I could take to make it go away, I just would. I'd rather not feel it. You know what that feels like. What would you say to that person?
Oh, what's the one thing? So self-observation will be one thing, and it's more intricate, so I don't think we can get into the depths of it here. What I would try to say is that it's okay to feel anxiety. It's normal and it's natural. But the big thing I would say is stop fighting it, because if you fight it, you're only feeding it. There's a great metaphor that I heard for anxiety. It comes from acceptance and commitment therapy, and it's like you're in a tug of war with the anxiety monster, and there's a big pit in the middle of the tug of war. So you're pulling one end of the rope, the monster's pulling the other, but he's much stronger. And if you keep on pulling, he's just going to win and pull you into the pit. So what do? You drop the rope. Mm-hmm. So the anxiety is still there. The monster's still on the other side of the pit. But when you drop the rope, you stop fighting that monster, and you can do something else to improve, like meditation, self-observation techniques as well. Now, nothing good comes quick or easy. So it's that consistency piece comes in as well. But believe in the process then as well, that if you keep on practicing the tools that people are talking about, it will work, and you will see improvements.
And I suppose you can speak from experience in that your fear that you won't be able to cope with anxiety is much bigger in someone's head right now than your actual ability to cope when you're willing to sit down and embrace and the feelings and sit with the discomfort. You know now that you have proven that you can face those feelings and cope with it. And now going forward, you know that your ability to cope is always going to be bigger than your fear that you can't.
Definitely, definitely. And that's even self-reinforcing as well, because when you have them little mini realizations, you're like, wow, this stuff works. And it helps you to practice them tools even more and give you more confidence in them going forward. And it's like a snowball rolling down a hill. It gets bigger and bigger, more powerful. That can happen with negative thinking, but it's brilliant because it also happens with positive thinking as well and these kinds of tools.
Amazing. Brian, so for people who want to know more, hopefully they won't be harassing you with messages, but you've got so many resources there. So what's your website again?
So the website is www.brianpenny.com. So it's P-E-N-N-I-E for Penny, and everything is there, like all my social media platforms, my blog, my videos. I'm going to be putting up a section for my online courses there as well, and my book link.
And the book is widely available online and in stores, and because I have an awful lot of listeners in the UK, actually, more so than I have in Ireland. So it's there as well if they want to get it online.
Yeah, it's on. So go to you can get it there on my website, and the links to Amazon, the links to the audiobook, the ebook, and it's on, the audiobook's on Amazon as well. So everything's there, it's on all the major publishing platforms.
Amazing. Brian, I don't know what to say. I'm so grateful for your willingness to share everything that you've shared with me, and I think it'll be with me for the rest of the day and the weekend. And I'm so I don't know if it's weird to say, but I'm so proud of you as a person to have faced that adversity and come through, and not only have helped yourself, but like you're going to help so many, and you already have helped so many people. And even if you just make a difference in one person's life, that's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, even just planting a seed in one person's life, it's amazing. And really, I just absolutely loved the conversation, Caroline. Delighted that you invited me on. It was brilliant. Really loved it.
Thank you so much for giving me your time. And I don't doubt that people will really, really appreciate this episode. So wishing you the best of luck with the book and everything else. And hopefully when we're out of this pandemic, we'll meet in person, because I feel like maybe we were two souls that were meant to cross paths at some point.
I think so, Caroline. I think so. And very best luck with the new arrival as well. I get to see when we meet up, I'll see the baby as well. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Okay, take care.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinis.
I'm Kayla Itzinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.